Welcome to the UK and World News Channel on Orpio, powered by Audioboom. In this show, David Cameron, the UK Prime Minister, has set out why he thinks the UK needs to act militarily in Syria. We hear from the Stop the War campaign. Heathrow was disrupted today by a protest group, Plain Stupid. We find out what happened, and the Christmas-themed delicacy that's causing upset among animal rights groups. But first, the latest global headlines from the AP newsroom.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. The Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade is underway, and millions of New Yorkers and others are enjoying the weather, the balloons, and the marching bands. Our Julie Walker's in the crowd.
Here at the parade, it's all about the giant character balloons. Whether it's Snoopy, Hello Kitty, SpongeBob, or Angry Birds Red, they're all looming high above the street for everyone to get a great view. And there are lots of people out here, thanks in part to the great weather. The sun is shining and it's a mild day for late November. Mayor Bill de Blasio told me that estimates are about 3.5 million people, which he says proves that those who would try to scare and intimidate us to stay away did not win today. At the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, I'm Julie Walker.
New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton underscores that thought.
The world has changed, unfortunately, but we can still live a great life free of fear. In the case of New York, you got 35,000 cops who know what they're doing and are there to protect you.
He was on CBS this morning. President Obama's Thanksgiving message is an appeal to the nation to shelter thousands more Syrian refugees, an idea that's put him on a collision course with a worried Congress following the terror attacks in Paris.
People should remember that no refugee can enter our borders until they undergo the highest security checks of anyone traveling to the United States. That was the case before Paris, and it's the case now.
We are getting a clearer look this morning at how Russia plans to retaliate against Turkey after it shot down a Russian warplane. We're learning Moscow will cut important economic ties, impose sanctions, and dump big investment projects that were planned. Four people under arrest in Chicago after a second night of largely peaceful protests over the killing of a black 17-year-old by a white police officer. This is AP Radio News. Are you going shopping today? Thanksgiving Day? Many Americans appear to be conflicted about whether they should or want to. Retail analyst Ron Sides is with Deloitte, the financial services firm.
It's really a tale of two consumers. So the consumers who really want to go shop, about 23% said they wanted to be there earlier than 5 p.m. on Thanksgiving. And yet, you know, there's a large number who really didn't want to be shopping on Thanksgiving.
He says the stores have to step up their game to attract consumers.
What we're finding is that retailers are having to be more aggressive to get folks through the door, and especially over the holiday weekend. And so as a result, I think we're going to see the promotional period continue to go up and the offers as well.
Ron Sides, the vice chairman of retail with Deloitte Financial Services. JCPenney opens at 3 this afternoon and will stay open all night into tomorrow, Black Friday. Target, Macy's, and Sears open at 6 this evening. I'm Rita Foley, AP Radio News.
David Cameron has told the UK Parliament that he thinks launching UK airstrikes against Islamic State militants that are based in Syria will make the UK safer. LBC spoke to the Stop the War campaign.
What are you sensing from this debate?
Well, I mean, I thought that the case that Cameron put to Parliament was, as one of the MPs said, very, very thin. I thought it was incoherent and dangerous. And really adds nothing to what we already knew that he and the hawks around him want.
But what about, I mean, well, there was one thing I hadn't heard before, most definitely, which was this notion of, and I don't know the truth of it, the facts of it, but 70,000 Syrian fighters who are definitely not extremists that could do the fighting on the ground, the combat troops that could be engaged.
Well, as Julian Lewis said, I mean, no one's heard that figure from anywhere before, and the figures that actual experts who've been on the ground in Syria tend to go with are more like half that. And the Free Syrian Army, insofar as it exists at all, is fragmented, is broken, and demoralised. And I mean, really, this is one of the many elements of fantasy in David Cameron's presentation. There really isn't, and there aren't forces on the ground of the kind he talks about. In fact, the US has been trying to put together a so-called moderate Syrian army now for months, and it's repeatedly failed. It's not going to happen. I think this shows the kind of the fact that really he is in once again cobbling together a kind of an attempted rationale for bombing, but it's not a coherent plan of any kind.
He's clearly convincing some previously sceptical conservative MPs. Has your organisation been lobbying hard, Labour MPs and perhaps conservatives as well?
Yeah. No, we have. I mean, we've had a very big lobbying campaign, the biggest that we've ever had. We've had 25,000 people lobbying just through our own website. But we've also had, you know, real-world local lobbies. And, I mean, what we
What do you mean by that? I mean, have you and your members sat down with MPs
absolutely.
And over coffee and talked it through? Tell me what, I mean, you don't need to name them, but tell me what their concerns are.
Well, I think there's a huge amount of confusion, really. I mean, obviously, people feel rightly that ISIS is a big problem and has to be dealt with. But I think that they want to see a plan that is more than just a kind of, you know, knee-jerk military intervention. And although today's Cameron tried to dress up his plan in a kind of some sort of sense of a wider strategy, really, I think he failed comprehensively to do that. And there's so many things. I mean, for example, the idea that the gap between the various different groups involved or powers involved in intervening in Syria at the moment is closing. I mean, that's absurd. We've just had a situation where Turkey shot down a Russian jet. We came close to a widening of the war in a terrifying way. How can he possibly say? And on top of that, Russia is at the moment, as even the West says, Russia is bombing the very forces which David Cameron believes that we should be aligned with.
The thing
with.
Is, though, Chris, David Cameron, he's made it clear. He says we're not naive in the complexity of this task. He knows it's dangerous. He knows it's risky. He knows it's complex. You do. I do. We all know that. But what is your alternative vision?
Well, first of all, I mean, I'll come on to that, but first of all, there are no nuances or complexities in the actual proposals that David Cameron put forward at all, just assertions, many of which are clearly untrue.
Well, there are, because if there weren't, we'd have just carpet-bombed Raqqa by now, wouldn't we? There are nuances.
Well, I mean, that's not a nuance. He tried to do that.
No, he didn't. Nobody's tried to carpet bomb Raqqa.
In 2013, David Cameron brought a resolution to Parliament asking us, actually, to attack Assad, which would have strengthened the very people that he now wants us to take on. So, yeah, David Cameron's been wanting war on Syria for a long time, and he still wants war on Syria.
But you know the threat is different now, don't you, Chris? You know the threat is different now.
Well, the threat is different because the war has expanded, and that actually the U.S., and France, and Syria, and Jordan, and the UAE, and a whole bunch of other countries, including Canada and Australia, have been doing exactly what David Cameron is asking us to do for 13 months. And in that time, according to the US, ISIS has strengthened, both in terms of it's increased its territorial command, and it's increased its recruitment. So why is it that a policy that has been a complete failure up to now is suddenly going to be any different because a few extra British planes were on board? This is not serious.
But I still haven't heard your alternative vision.
No, well, that's fine. I mean, our alternative vision is that we should try and imagine a foreign policy that isn't based on dropping munitions on foreign countries.
As plain stupid's protest caused chaos at Heathrow today, one taxi driver phoned Nick at LBC with a passenger in tears in the back of their cab because she was going to miss her flight.
Abdul's in Heathrow. What's happened, Abdul? Are you stuck in this traffic?
Absolutely. Hi, Nick. Hi. You know, it is a disaster. These people should be immediately arrested by the police.
Yes.
I got an old lady passenger inside the car and she crying. You know, she after 2 years, she did to manage to get a holiday, and now she's missing the flight, and she's crying inside the car.
Of course.
These people should be arrested. You know, this is illegal in this country. Go and demonstrate outside Heathrow. Not, you know, shutting the tunnels. You know, thousand people, they're going to miss their flight.
I know.
And I'm as a taxi driver losing my time, and the lady's crying now. She missed the flight.
I know. I'm terribly sorry. Have you managed to drop her off, or is she still with you?
No. There's a car park here.
Would she like to speak with me, Abdul?
No, you know, she's crying.
She's crying too much. Well, it's very distressing for you.
I'm afraid, you know, Nick, these people are really irresponsible people. I live in this area, and I, you know, if you want to do demonstration, go outside, you know, Oslo Town Hall and demonstrate, or outside Downing Street, not shutting the Heathrow, you know, irresponsible people, absolutely crazy people, you know. And they should be arrested, you know, immediately.
And are you in the tunnel or just caught in the traffic outside of the tunnel?
Outside the tunnel, you know, everybody parked their car and just, you know...
I know exactly where you are. Well, try and comfort the woman as best you can. That's absolutely hideous. Exactly the point I was trying to make.
And an animal rights group have hit out at the supermarket chain Lidl for selling smoked cured reindeer steak. The Nolan Show has the debate.
An animal rights group has hit out at Lidl for selling smoke-cured reindeer steak. Aaron, the Animal Rights Action Network, is urging parents to avoid bringing their children to the stores in the run-up to Christmas. There's nothing festive nor cheerful about the sale of reindeer meat in Irish little stores, says Aaron's John Kermody, who's with us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning to you. And the local butcher and owner of Hillstown Butcher, Sam Chesney's with us today. Good morning to you, Sam.
Good morning, Stephen. Actually, I'm not a butcher, but I'm a farmer, but I understand where the whole thing's coming from.
Right. John, what's the problem here?
Oh, dear. Well, I suppose, Stephen, right now, many of your listeners are gearing up all across Northern Ireland, you know, for the festivities of Christmas. And I think we've all grown up with the iconic reindeer being Rudolph and Santa, that kind of thing. We remember him, you know, we know in the run-up to Christmas, he's going to be landing on all our rooftops, delivering the gifts. But quite seriously, we've just learned over the last number of weeks that there's reindeer meat on sale in you know, various supermarkets across the country that's selling reindeer meat. So really and truly what we're trying to bring attention to is that it's quite ironic in the run-up to Christmas that on one hand, you know, we're promoting Christmas and Rudolph and Santa and stuff like that, and yes, we have reindeer who are cut up and chopped up and packaged on sale in freezers and in supermarkets, which we think is a bit ironic. So we want to call attention to it, and we're asking parents, just like you said there, to keep their children out of these supermarkets in the run-up to Christmas. We do not want to be disturbing them or probably, I suppose, messing up their Christmas. Yeah, for sure.
Well, Lidl themselves, just to clarify this, they will be selling chopped up reindeer, as you put it, in the Republic of Ireland and their UK stores, but they will not be stocking reindeer in Northern Ireland. So let's just clarify this. When they say, in fact, they haven't said UK stores, so let's just be careful here. They will be selling it. I presume they're saying they'll be selling it in their stores across the water, their Britain stores, but not in Northern Ireland due to space constraints in the refrigeration of their stores here in Northern Ireland. Okay, go on, Sam.
Total lunacy, you know, really. In the Nordic countries where the reindeers come from, that's probably their staple diet. Those animals in the Nordic countries look after the biodiversity of that land, eating lichen and moss and things like that there. I bet you the people in the Nordic countries would like a bit of turkey or a bit of roast beef at Christmas. And sure, we all know, Stephen, that, you know, Santa's reindeer are kept in a special garden beside his factory. And they're special reindeer, and they get special angel dust so they can fly, not the ones that Lidl are selling. You can rest assured that Lidl will not have sourced a product that they don't know that is well looked after and well handled before.
Well, you see, this is the problem I have just with animals being killed in general, because we've always heard for a long time that so long as they're being killed, it's almost acceptable to eat them. But in reality, you know, we do know that from working with campaigners in Siberia and in Russia and in Sweden who have documented reindeer being killed for their meat for various types of butchers and supermarkets, even in Sweden and Russia, we do know that these animals are herded up by helicopters, snowmobiles, motorcycles, that kind of thing. And, you know, really and truly what we're trying to say is that these animals have to be herded up and lassoed, and then their tendons are cut with metal, you know.
I don't know, but
I'm not going to go into too much detail on it.
Yeah, I can understand why helicopters are involved, because they're dealing with vast areas of land. If you look at Northern Ireland, it'll fit inside Russia about 100 times. So if you're looking at vast areas of land, just like the outback of Australia, they have to round up sheep and cattle with helicopters. But the area is so vast. These farmers who look after their reindeers, I bet you they look after them the best of their ability. You know, we can't...
Do you not think there's something wrong with in the run up to Christmas we're pushing the reindeers into children's hands and we see them in supermarkets and we're encouraging kids to buy everything that's associated with Rudolph and reindeers and Santa, that kind of thing. And yet here we have them packaged, you know, and on sale in a supermarket in the run up to Christmas.
Well, really, we've lost the full meaning of Christmas. Christmas was about the baby Jesus born in a stable in Bethlehem. And if you do go to those countries like Poland and Russia, at Christmas you will see very few Santa Clauses and very few Christmas trees. It's more of a religious festival. And, you know, it's really commercialization that's taken Santa Claus, the elves, and Rudolph and the rest of them onto our roofs at night. It's a very nice fable.
Stephen
to have.
Barnes writes to me and says, I've never heard anything as daft. Don't eat reindeer because children will be upset. Let's ban carrots in case the snowmen get upset.
Well, you know what, Stephen?
Yes, Stephen, you're right. You're right.
I think the good thing about this is it's given us a chance even to talk about the fact that even in the run-up to Christmas, we're going to have turkeys as tabletop centrepieces as well. And I think
do reindeer taste nice?
I would assume it tastes a wee bit like venison. It's a game, Stephen. It would be a gamey type of taste. And I have eaten reindeer. I suppose we could also say we shouldn't be eating crocodiles and slugs because they're eating them down in the jungle at the minute in Australia. So you have to take everything with a pinch of salt. If you want to eat reindeer, eat reindeer. And if you don't want to eat reindeer, don't eat reindeer.
And discussing the latest news and current affairs, here is the Pacey, the briefing from London's Midori House and Monocle 24.
This edition of the briefing was first broadcast on the 26th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the programme, all eyes today on Turkey as the government releases audio showing it did, in fact, warn a Russian fighter jet to turn away from Turkish airspace before it was shot down. We'll ask how Russia can maintain its denial in the face of new evidence. Then we're in Brazil as a senior senator and a billionaire CEO are both arrested for corruption. And we'll also ask a veteran Yemen-based journalist why the United Arab Emirates has sent hundreds of Latin American mercenaries to fight in that conflict. All that, plus the business news from our friends at Bloomberg and much more, all right here on The Briefing with me, Steve Bloomfield. Lots to pack into over the next 30 minutes, and let's begin with a look at the front pages, which are landing on doorsteps across Latin America. Fernando Augusto Pacheco is with us. Faye, thank you very much for joining us today. Let's begin with Clarín, where there is a picture of, lots and lots of men on the front of the paper. Tell us why.
Lots of middle-aged white men.
Yep.
And that's the new cabinet of President Mauricio Macri, who was elected this weekend. And you're right, Steve, actually, only 3 out of the 24 ministers are women, actually. And from what I can see, there's no one from some sort of ethnic minority. And again, a lot of bankers as well. The new finance minister, of course, is Alfonso Prat Gay. He used to be central bank chief of Argentina before the Kirchners were in power. And of course, he studied in the US, like many of those ministers did. In fact, I mean, there's some interesting ones as well. Like, for example, the new foreign minister, Susana Malcora, one of the few women there. She used to be the chief of staff of Ban Ki-moon at the UN. So that's quite an important post as well. So, you know, there's some.
So at least there, it suggests that there might be a sort of a more thoughtful foreign policy, some would say, than
more diplomatic,
yes,
I would say.
Than what's been over the previous few years, which has basically been all about the Falklands, Malvinas, whichever you decide to call it. But yes, very, very pale, very male. Where else do you want us to go?
Well, let's go to Brazil. I'm going to mention it briefly because I know we're going to be discussing more at the show. I have O Estado de São Paulo in front of me. And Steve, is huge news because a senator from the Workers' Party was arrested. He was the first senator to be arrested while in office. And, you know, it's been proved because there was a tape. And basically, he was planning the escape of a former Petrobras director. And he said that he would even pay him a small bribe to keep it silent. That's a huge scandal. And I think this is going to affect Dilma's government quite a lot. I think more than any other arrest that we've seen at the Operation Car Wash, which is investigating Petrobras. Okay. Very shocking news indeed.
We'll be discussing that in more detail a little later with Tiago de Araujo. Where else? You want to go to the New York Times, don't you, for a brief story?
Let's end on a lighter note.
Yeah, why not?
Very nice story here about Macy's. You know, the, you know, of course, the iconic shop in New York. They had a $400 million renovation. But there was an interesting thing, because one of their most traditional things were the escalators, which were built in the 20s, and they were built of oak and ash. They managed to keep that, and they're saying this is one of the few things that you could do in New York in the 20s, and you can still do it now. And I've been there, actually. They're quite beautiful and quite interesting. I'm glad they kept those escalators.
There we are. A story about escalators somehow makes the front of the New York Times, and actually, it's quite a nice story. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much indeed. That's what's making the headlines on the front pages in the Americas, both north and south. Let's get the business news now. Pim Fox from Bloomberg is standing by. Pim, where do you want us to start today?
Well, we'll pick up where Fernando left off, because we're talking about Macy's and retail sales. You know, yesterday we got the report about personal spending, and it showed that Americans were saving more of their money than before. Personal savings rate up 5.6%. Now, that may be great for individuals, but it's not great for retailers. They, of course, depend on retailers spending lots of money during this holiday shopping season. Now, Black Friday is tomorrow. This is the all-important holiday shopping kickoff, and it typically begins after Thanksgiving. But the issue is that a lot of research shows that Black Friday has disappointed retailers, mainly because overall consumer spending since the beginning of 2014, while it has risen at a rate of about 3% a year, most stores aren't going to see those kinds of pops. As a result, retailers who are going to try to ring up maybe somewhere in the order of $60 to $65 billion worth of spending, a lot of that, of course, is going online, because that you can do 24/7. So we're going to be waiting to see what happens when the stores open. Some of them are going to be open today. Target, for example, is offering 10 days of deals that have led up to today. Old Navy is going to stay open for 32 consecutive hours beginning at 4 p.m. Eastern today. So you're not going to have lack of store opening in order to assuage your shopping guilt. Let me just also mention that, you know, what's closely tied to shopping is your income. You don't have money, you don't spend. A week from tomorrow, we're going to be getting the November jobs report. Now, this is the last jobs report before it's expected that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates 25 basis points. Having said that, this jobs report is important because it will talk about the pace of interest rate increases. If we see big gains in jobs, if we see a big decline in the unemployment rate, that may call for even further rate increases, something that, at least when you take a look at the GDP of the United States, about 2-2.5%, is not actually boding well for rate increases, because that's not a sign that the economy is all that strong. But we're going to have to wait to see next week, next Friday. That's the big report. Everyone's going to be waiting for it, and that's what everyone's going to be trading on. We're going to see what happens to the jobs report.
Pim Fox, very succinct. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. That was Pim Fox from Bloomberg. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. It's become the Cold War throwback story of the year. Turkey shoots down a Russian fighter plane, the first time a NATO country has done any such thing in almost half a century. And it's descended into a game of he said and he said. Russia denies its plane encroached on Turkish airspace and denies as well that its pilots were warned. Yet the Turkish government has now released audio confirming its side of the story. The recording was made available to the AP news service today and demonstrates that the pilots were warned several times. So how can Russia continue to maintain its side of the story in denial of new facts? Joining us now is Igor Sutyagin, a research fellow in Russian studies at the London-based think tank RUSI. Igor, thank you very much for joining us today. First of all, how have the Russians responded to the Turks releasing this audio?
Well, actually, that is a very, very mixed reaction. The official statement is that the pilots say, and the navigator which survived the shooting down plane, he says that they did not hear that. Russian reaction is that it's faked, so it's just recorded separately. And that is not that pleasant thing, but the another part of the reaction is the Russian line, propaganda line, that actually that doesn't matter because we never crossed the border. That is the official line. But unofficially or semi-officially, even Vladimir Putin says, well, actually, we've been there for 17 seconds. It's just so tiny, tiny amount of time. Why to shoot us down? We never represented any threat. So that is the mixed reaction.
Igor, when this first began, there were a number of commentators who were saying, look, it looks bad, it could be bad, but it doesn't necessarily have to be catastrophic. Both sides will want to try to tamp this down. Do you think that's actually played out there over the last few days, or do you think actually the rhetoric has become actually quite heated on both sides?
Well, the problem is that if you think that there is just one Vladimir Putin on this planet, you are wrong. There are two Putins there, and the name of the second one is Erdogan. And so when two Putins meet each other, it is inevitably very hot. So that is why rhetoric will be inevitably very hot. What is more serious is the actions, which are being undertaken and mainly being undertaken by the Russian side. Because the attack on the Turkish embassy in Moscow yesterday, it was a very serious step because it's just one step before proclamation of war. So that is very unpleasant. At the same time, not only two, all three sides of this conflict, they are terribly interested in cooling it down. It is Turks who wanted to make the point, they've done it, they do not need the conflict. It is Russia who is in an uneasy situation, who needs to break through the isolation to reestablish its contacts with the West, with NATO, and well, you cannot cut Turkey from NATO, so it is not interesting for Russia. Russia is in the middle of very uneasy negotiations with Turkey, and you should not forget that Turkey is the second largest consumer of the Russian gas, which means that approximately 10 to 12% of Russian government's income come from Turkey for this gas. That is terribly wrong time to damage to make harm to relations with the Turkey. And the West in general, they are not interested in this additional complication of this Middle East conflict. So from the rational standpoint, all three sides are interested in the resolution of this conflict. The problem is that there is inertia, there is domestic pressure, and there is emotions. And it seems that they are pushing forward, well, against the will of the actors, especially on the Russian side. It's pushing very dangerously to the very dangerous actions.
Igor, if you had to make a best prediction of where this situation will be in 3 months' time, do you think that those rational arguments that, okay, first of all, ISIS is the threat that everyone can unite around, and second of all, that Russia and Turkey have this economic relationship as well, which both want to keep going, don't want to jeopardize right now. Do you think that those arguments are more likely to win out than the perhaps more emotional, irrational arguments?
Well, it seems to me that emotions probably will play the major role in the immediate reactions and immediate actions right now. In 3 months' time, emotions will they will create obstacles, and it seems that on the Russian side, these obstacles will be in place. But I do think that it will be inevitable development that the situation will calm down, because Russia just does not have resources to carry out this conflict, neither Turkey, as a matter of fact. So I think in 3 months' time, the situation will be cooler than now, because by that time it will become absolutely obvious for the Kremlin that these emotions were counterproductive. Putin and the Kremlin, his military hawks, you know, now proclaim that we will establish, you know, control over all their space in Syria. That is great, but that means that the Kremlin says, I take the full and absolute responsibility for what's happening in Syria and with Daesh. Well, you're welcome. you're welcome, you will be the first to blame. And in 3 months' time, it will be absolutely obvious for the Kremlin that it was a wrong move.
Okay. Igor Sutyagin, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Igor Sutyagin, a research fellow in Russian studies at the London-based think tank RUSI. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinion and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. It's 12:14 here in London, 7:14 in Washington, D.C. The New York Times has reported on a story today that would perhaps be more at home than a John Le Carre novel or even a Bond film. Hundreds of Latin American mercenaries have apparently been dispatched to Yemen by the United Arab Emirates to help fill the widening security vacuum in the country. So who are these fighters? Where do they come from? And will it further complicate an already incredibly complex conflict? We turn now to Monocle 24 contributor and independent journalist Iona Craig, often found in Yemen, but she joins us now from London. Iona Craig, welcome to The Briefing. First of all, put this story in a bit of context for us. We've had ongoing war inside Yemen for some time now with the Houthis, the Saudis and many others. What's the situation like right now?
It's a bit of a mess, to be honest. There's a ground war which was launched originally in July is now being fought on about 8 fronts across the country. And, of course, as we all know, that means you need a lot of ground troops. The Saudis are extremely reluctant to send their own men in, because when you send your own men in, that inevitably means you're sending casualties and dead bodies back home eventually. And that raises questions at home and perhaps undermines the war effort. So, yes, the Saudis are very reluctant and haven't really sent in any of their troops in large numbers. The Emiratis have been the ones that have been really making waves on the ground. They sent in many thousand troops and as well as providing serious amounts of equipment. The Sudanese have also more recently been involved and sent a battalion into the south. We've had Senegalese troops involved, and this is now just the latest in sort of what's becoming an increasingly international affair in Yemen. And the Saudis have also been trying to train Yemenis. So they've taken, in the last couple of months, several hundred Yemenis out of the country and are training them in both Eritrea and in the United Arab Emirates with the hope of sending them back to Yemen to fight. But I think what really the question raises out of all of this is these are mercenaries that have been paid a lot of money. We're talking several thousand dollars a month. They're now reportedly going to be getting a bonus once they're in country. Now, your average Yemeni soldier will be getting less than $200 a month, never mind several thousand dollars a month. And the Yemenis are the ones that have been at the front line doing the majority of the fighting. So I think this is going to cause issues literally on the battlefield when you have these now Colombian mercenaries or Latin American mercenaries earning thousands of dollars being put up at the same time as Yemeni fighters who are going to be lucky if they're getting $200 a month.
And all this is happening, Iona, while on the whole, the West either turns a blind eye to it or gives its tacit approval and asks the rest of us not really to look into it too closely.
Absolutely. Of course, you know, America and Britain are both supporting this conflict, not just by providing weapons and bombs, most crucially for the air war, but also intelligence and logistic support. So, you know, the US are, yes, helping support with with finding targets for bombings, but also refueling of aeroplanes on a daily basis. So yeah, there's quite a lot of hands-on involvement, and there's not a huge amount of information getting out of Yemen about what's going on. A lot of the human rights organisations have been trying to raise awareness of accusations of contravention of human rights law and international rules of war and potential war crimes, but it's an incredibly difficult conflict to cover. But it's very difficult for journalists to get in the country and to operate on the ground. And that's hugely convenient for both the UK and the US when there are questions being raised about the way the conflict is being fought.
And one of the ways the conflict is often described is in sort of very sort of black and white terms, as if it's a sort of a Sunni Shia thing, and the Houthis are backed by Iran, and many of these the people that we are sort of tacitly supporting are actually fighting Al Qaeda. So therefore, this is a good battle between good and evil. How much truth is there, any truth at all, in that sort of grand narrative?
No, I mean, it's much more nuanced than that. But the problem is it also becomes slightly self-fulfilling. So really, this was always a domestic political power struggle. So it was about the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, using the Houthis, who are a predominantly Shia group, to fight the current government of President Hadi and his supporters, some of whom are from the Islam Party, which is a Sunni political party, very similar to the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, when you look at it in more detail, you will see that actually the loyalists of Ali Abdullah Saleh who are fighting with Houthis are also Sunni. So you've got mixed groups on both sides. Then you drop into that, yes, the Iranian aspect. Of course, this is Saudi Arabia's huge paranoia. There is very little evidence to back up the claims that the Iranians have given military or financial support to the Houthis. They definitely have given them some support, certainly political, but even the U.S. has acknowledged that the Iranians tried to stop them from marching into Sana'a back in September last year. So to say that they are still driving this conflict from behind, I think is a gross exaggeration. But it certainly, from a Saudi perspective, plays into the regional power struggle, where you do see now state actors fighting against proxies, whether it now be in Yemen or whether it's in Syria and Iraq. This has now become a regional issue and you're dragging in multiple nations when you're bringing in all these different fighters from different parts of the world. So yes, it's become a very global conflict, but without much global attention.
Iona Craig, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. That was Iona Craig reporting for us on the situation in Yemen. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. To Brazil now, where for the first time, as we were hearing a little earlier, a sitting senator has been arrested for corruption alongside a billionaire CEO. They are the latest casualties in the gigantic Petrobras investigation in the country, which we've been covering extensively here on Monocle 24. Joining me now for his analysis is Thiago de Araújo, a senior research associate at the Foreign Policy Centre. Thiago, thank you very much for joining us today. We heard at the beginning of the programme how this is all over the front of the Brazilian newspapers. This arrest of a sitting senator, how important is it in the grander scheme of this massive Petrobras investigation, which has been going on for some time now?
Well, hello. It's a pleasure to be talking with you guys. Well, this is a major, major impact in not only in Brazilian politics, but also to Brazilian society. And this is being interpreted by several segments of society, not only as very good news, not only for the investigation itself, but for the country, which is demonstrating a continuous strength in its institutionality that very few thought that Brazil had, which is very typical of non-Latin American countries to have this type of strength in institutional terms. So the arrest of this senator who was clearly obstructing justice is something that had an impact which until now not only the government but the society still questioning themselves how the investigators had the strength to do that.
And what do you think happens next? Because, you know, as we've seen before with corruption investigations in Brazil, when, you know, politicians might be under investigation, but whether they're actually then brought to trial and prosecuted and, you know, spend the rest of their life in prison, that doesn't necessarily always happen.
No, and of course that there must be an adjustment of expectations. We are not in a stage yet that you're going to see any politician spending the life in jail, especially because no one in Brazil by law can spend life in jail, as 30 years is the limit. But what happens is that, yes, we had seen major politicians being arrested in the past 8 years during corruption investigations, but it's completely different from the past, which when they were immune to anything. So we are moving in a ladder of institutionality that we must be very responsible not to transform the anger of a corrupt environment into a revenge, but also to move forward and ensure that we're not going to back down and we're going to resist any typical situation of falling back and giving some sort of help and support for those corrupt politicians. So we must understand well where we are in this development.
And how hopeful are you that this will actually make a difference, that that, you know, subsequent generations of politicians will perhaps be less susceptible to bribery as the many of the current crop seem to be?
Well, it is already making a very big change. For example, by law, with a law that was approved a few years ago, no one can run for a public position if they were convicted in second stance in any situation. Second, it was approved a few months ago that private financing of campaign is now prohibited, and this was the main vehicle of corruption when a company legally donated $1 million, $2 million, $3 million of pounds to a certain politician and obviously expected a return for this investment that they made. Now that this is prohibited, it is already changing the dynamics strongly. And third, the fact that the federal police, which is fully autonomous, and the judiciary system are going through senators and raiding the house of the son of the former president demonstrates that now the game is becoming more equal to everyone.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Thiago de Araújo, Senior Research Associate at the Foreign Policy Centre, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing here on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's edition of The Briefing, a senior British politician from the Labour Party, the Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, yesterday in Parliament, turned to the Little Red Book, Chairman Mao's Book of Wisdoms. He was hoping that his own supporters would be delighted and that his opponents, the Tories, would be shamed. It didn't quite work out like that. Too much mirth. Certainly on the Tory benches. He was mocked, not just in the chamber, but also in the newspapers today. But we're joined now by Enzé Hahn, a senior lecturer in the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS, to find out how the Chinese are reacting to this. Has this made the press in China? Are they intrigued or amused by the sight of a British politician quoting from Mao?
It did. So many, some of the major Chinese websites and quoted it, but somehow there is, I think there is a misquote. Basically, the intention that, for example, he's shaming the conservative government in selling out to Chinese, that part was not mentioned.
Okay, because, so, of course, that was the thing that he was...
Exactly.
Which also really got lost in the coverage here, is that he was trying to mock George Osborne for being too friendly to the Chinese and said, you might need some help from this.
Right, so the Chinese press, the one I saw, sort of put a spin on it, saying that, you know, apparently the British Labour Party is quoting Mao, right? And then this is not necessarily, I mean, Mao is no longer it's a very controversial figure in China as well, right? But then sometimes it's part of the political battle between the new left in China versus the ones who's more like pro-capitalist, whatever. So some websites, when they put these things up, it naturally led to fighting among netizens in terms of how they view Mao and its legacies. But then the interesting part essentially is that the marking part of basically, for example, the intention for McDonald to quote Mao as a way to shame the current government for selling out Chinese, that part was not mentioned.
It's interesting that both here in the UK and in China, the intention was somewhat lost for different reasons. How much is Mao Zedong actually sort of used by politicians in China now? Who tends to sort of refer to him or what he did in a good way?
Well, Mao is more controversial than Deng Xiaoping, for example. But then again, he is considered as the founding person for the PRC, and his name is on the Tiananmen Square and on the money. But then again, sometimes he became a figure, sort of figure between the outside mentioned the new left, which there are some intellectuals and whatever who like scholars who buy into the Maoism kind of argument versus the people who are in the government or in the economy who might want to push for more liberalization. So sometimes it's not necessarily about Mao per se, rather it's about the ideological battle within the communist party itself. So usually, for example, in any major event, perhaps Mao's name will be mentioned, but often is mentioned in conjunction with other people like Deng Xiaoping or other things. It's not necessarily specifically singled out.
Okay, unlikely, we imagine, that John McDonnell will be quoted anytime soon by Chinese politicians. Enze Han, thank you very much for joining us today. That's it for The Briefing. It was produced by Daniel Jacopelli, researched by Guy Lutz, Piers Ellison and Clara Strunk. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Carlotta Ribello will be with you next. The Briefing is back at the same time tomorrow. That is 12 noon here in London. That's 7 a.m. in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
You've been listening to the UK and World News Channel on Orpio, powered by Audioboom.